Hi, my name is Kirk Kinder, and this is Saving Yourself from Wall Street, the podcast for people who want to avoid Wall Street's sales tactics, high cost, and conflicted advice so they can take control of their financial life. So let's get to it. In this week's podcast, we're going to be talking to Ron DeLegge. Now, I've known Ron for over 15 years now. He and I used to speak at industry conferences on exchange-traded funds or ETFs way back in the day. And the thing that always got me to Ron is I was always amazed at his enthusiasm to champion the individual investor against the high fees and conflicts of the typical Wall Street firms and brokers. We were always kind of kindred souls when it came to that. Now, you may know Ron from his radio show. Ron's hosted the Index Investing Show since 2005. As the weekly voice, Ron has analyzed more than $200 million in retirement portfolios to help people see if their investments are healthy or sick. He's also the founder of ETFGuide.com, which provides all kinds of research and information pertaining to exchange-traded funds. And he's also the inventor of the Portfolio Report Card grading system. That's what Ron uses often on his radio show to tell people if their portfolios are looking good or if they're sick. Now, Ron's also the author of several books, and today we're going to discuss his latest book, Habits of the Investing Greats. It's a really good book full of some interesting stories and tidbits, and I think Ron does a nice job in this interview of really describing what those are. So the other thing is Ron was generous enough to give me a couple copies of the new book for the Saving Yourself from Wall Street listeners. All you need to do to get your copy is leave a review of our podcast on iTunes, and we're hoping you'll please hook us up with a nice score. Once you do that, all you have to do is email kirk@savingyourselffromwallstreet.com and let me know what your username is on iTunes so I can confirm that you did leave a review, and then I'll send you the book. Now, the one thing is I can only send the book into U.S. addresses. I'm not doing any international shipping just because of the cost. So I do apologize if you're outside the U.S. But if you do that, I'll get you a nice copy of Ron's new book. I think you're going to get a lot of information and a lot out of this interview with Ron. So without further ado, here's the interview. Welcome to the show, Ron. I appreciate your time.
Kirk, it's great to be here.
Yeah, so it's been a little while since we chatted, but it's great to see you coming out with another book. It seems like every time I talk to you, you've got new ideas and new books coming out. But this one looks like it's going to be really a great book, Habits of the Investing Greats.
Yeah, so the idea with... Yeah, go ahead, I'm sorry.
Oh, no, go ahead. Yeah, I'd love to get your idea of why you wrote it.
Well, you know, I thought long and hard about something that was said by one of the investing greats. I think it was Ray Dalio, who said that it may have been Ray Dalio. It might have been Howard Marks. I don't remember. But they said that the hardest part about investing isn't so much the mathematics or economics of investing, but the psychology. And so I thought that was a very interesting statement, and it really leads back to how we think, how we act, how we behave. And of course, habits are behind that behavior. And so I thought, well, what are the habits that separate the truly great investors from everybody else? And how are we able to identify those habits? And then how are we able to link them to the investing greats? And more importantly, how can we implement them into our own investing regimen? And so that was sort of the genesis of this book, Habits of the Investing Greats. And then the subtitle is 26 Proven Tactics for Achieving the Results You Want. So that 26, there's actually 26 habits mentioned in the book. And I deliberately chose that number 26 because there's 26 weeks in a year. And so the idea is that each of us would practice one habit each week for half a year, 26 weeks. And then after that period is over, we could repeat the exercise again for another 26 weeks in chronological order or based on the order where we might need some work. So that was the idea behind the book.
Okay. Well, you know, as you looked at it with these 26 habits, like which did any of them stick out to you as like more important than the others? Like which ones were the critical habits that the investing greats all exemplified?
I think about this in terms of food. So which foods are most important? You know, is it the of the food group? You know, is it the dairy? Is it the meat, the vegetables? What is it? Is it the grains? And I think about habits sort of the same way. All of them are important in their own way. And in conjunction with each other, they provide a desirable end result. And so I think it's the same way with habits as it is with food, you know, having a balanced diet, you know, that's what dietitians or nutritionists will tell you. And I think the same thing applies to habits. I don't really think there's any one specific habit that's more important than the others. They're all important in their own okay. way. And when we act them out, the right habits together in unison, then I think the results on our investment performance and investment results will hopefully be positive.
Okay. Well, you know, what I really liked about your book is you did get to profile several just amazing investors. But when you were doing your research, did you find that there were any investors that you had a special kinship for or that really it kind of maybe changed you in the way you approach investing?
Well, I don't know if Chris Sacca has changed the way I invest, but I think he was one of the most amazing people that I studied and that is contained in this book. Sacca, for those of our listeners or your listeners that don't know, he, through his company called Lowercase, became an early investor in revered companies like Instagram, Kickstarter, Lookout, Stripe, Twitter, Twilio, Uber, I mean, on and on. And mm-hmm. his track record of success is just unbelievable. One of the most successful venture capitalists of all time. And yet, you look at how he began, it was a total disaster. In the late 90s, he had a $12 million gain in the stock market, and he actually turned that into a $4 million negative balance because he was over leveraged. And so, I mean, it's just amazing the turn of events and fortune that he suffered. And so, you know, he went into worked for a company called Fenwick and West, this venerable Silicon Valley law firm. And then he went on to work at Google, but he was still weighed down by this $4 million in debt from all those stock market losses after the great dot-com bust. And so he eventually paid that off in the mid 2000s. And what is so remarkable about Sacca to me is that he did not let his past mistakes permanently disable him. And he kept a firm eye on the road ahead. He kept chipping away. And I think he provides a very valuable life lesson in the importance of stability and cultivating the habit of being stable despite whatever setbacks that we may face in life. No matter how great they may be, accept that financial progress is rarely a straight line. That's what we okay. all have to understand.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Do you think that, like in his case, though, when you start to see some of his successes, do you think it's tied a little bit just to his focus on tech? I mean, if we had another, you know, it's pretty safe to say there's a lot of tech companies that have pretty expensive, you know, price to earnings ratios or, you know, market caps relative to sales and revenues. Do you think like he could face something like that again if tech struggled? Or do you feel he's learned his lesson enough now that he's not over leveraged
well, what he did was, yeah, his area of focus was startups, you know, companies and entrepreneurs that are trying to change the world. That was his focus. And he networked. He networked relentlessly, you know, working at that law firm, working at Google, you know, talking with people in his network. And that's how he was able to get the types of investments at such an early stage that others were not aware of. But what amazes me about him is that he converted obstacles in his life into money-making opportunities. And he created this situation of financial stability for himself by identifying and fixing problems that caused that instability in the first place. And so I think it's important for all of us to understand that setbacks, and we're all going to face them, no matter how devastating they may seem at the time, are temporary and they're just part of the process.
Okay. Yeah, that's a great lesson. You know, one story that really stuck out to me, and I think probably you as well, and I would bet most people listening to this have never heard the story of Ann Schieber. And honestly, I never had until I read your book. I was hoping maybe you could take a couple minutes and enlighten the folks on her story.
Yeah, I mean, Ann Schieber, you know, the one thing I'll mention about Habits of the Investing Greats that I think is important for people to understand is that to be an investing great, you don't have to be famous, and you most certainly don't have to be a billionaire. And one of the things that I enjoyed so much about writing this book was that I really deliberately included not just the famous, well-known investors, but I also deliberately included some of the people like Ann Schieber, the absolute greats, the giants that have been so overlooked and so understudied. Here's a woman who started out with just $5,000, and it managed to turn that $5,000 into a $22 million fortune. Now, this is also a person, by the way, who never earned more than $4,000 a year.
Yeah.
And she was a product of the Great Depression. And into the 70s and 80s, she grew her portfolio to over 140 different stocks. A lot of them contained losers, but some of them were pretty big hits, you know, grand slams, companies that at the time when she was investing them were not established. Companies like, you know, Chrysler and Paramount and Bristol-Myers Squibb and Coca-Cola. And so no one realized how great of an investor Schieber was until she passed away in 1995, and she ended up donating her fortune to a women's university called Yeshiva University. And up until now, I mean, she's still not very well known. She's still a pretty obscure figure. She's not a household name in financial circles, but that does not diminish her greatness. Her diligence, her commitment to long-term investing, and just letting her money compound over time. I mean, the results, she used absolutely no leverage, just incredible results. And another example of how cultivating the right habits leads to outstanding and superior results.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And one, I always like to get a take on it when I interview folks in the financial world. And you profiled this person in the book, Warren Buffett. So, you know, everybody loves Uncle Warren, you know, all his little Wall Street quips, and his Berkshire Hathaway annual meeting is a retreat for thousands of people. But, you know, a lot of times I'll look at him and a lot of the things he advocates publicly, when you actually look at his actions, he's almost doing kind of the opposite, it seems like. And I just wanted to kind of get your take on that. You know, little things, especially around like taxes. He's real big on saying the rich don't pay enough in taxes, but yet you look at his company and his personal wealth, and he's always doing things to really minimize taxes. And I don't blame him for that. But when you're saying he should pay more and he's actively moving to not, that, you know, that's a little bit of doublespeak there. And then, you know, the other thing is always saying invest in the S&P 500. It's the best investment you can do. But yet he's been sitting on over $20 billion of cash for a few years now. Do you kind of think, do you sort of see a dual personality with Warren, or do you think he's just the real deal?
Yeah, there's a split personality, definitely. I have not agreed with some of the things he's said about recently, you know, about taxes on the rich not being high enough. I don't agree with some of his takes on that. And there's some other things, but you know, I looked at his career and I asked myself, you know, so much has been said and written about him. And I asked myself, is there anything for me to add that hasn't already been said about the great Warren Buffett? And so in writing this book, I think I unearthed what I think is a real gem, an overlooked aspect of his investing career. And it deals specifically with the stock market era during which he was building his wealth. Before I go on, though, I want to ask you a question, Kirk. Mm-hmm. Have you ever played a card game where you were dealt a bad hand? Has that ever happened to you?
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
We've all played that game, right? And I think that's the same card game with a bad hand that Warren Buffett was given. And it's one of the seldom discussed aspects of his habitual greatness, and more specifically, his consistency. If you look at his track record, let's just go back to 1966. That 16-year period from 1966 forward, the Dow Jones Industrial Average got clobbered 45% during that 73-74 bear market and stayed flat until 1982. Seldom mentioned in all of that is how during that same time frame, which coincided with Buffett's age from 36 to 54, he still managed to grow his capital 14,000% by turning $7 million into almost $1 billion. Now, mm-hmm. you think about how difficult that is to do, even in a bull market. He did it in a market that was flat for 16 yeah. years. And that to me, that, by the way, is contained in this book, Habits of the Investing Greats. But that habit of consistency, which, you know, is just unbelievable. Unbelievable when you think about the context of the era that he began in. So, I mean, we obviously have a different era. We mm-hmm. live in a different time and age. We've had a bull market here in stocks, really, since the financial crisis. We haven't had an uncooperative market in quite some time.
Sure.
And yet many people haven't gotten their fair share of market returns, as good as the market's been. And to me, that's worrisome. That's worrisome. If people aren't able to do well during a friendly market climate like we've had right now, what's going to happen when the market starts to tank and really get bad? That's sort of a question I ask.
Well, sure. And it kind of switched topics here, but I mean, you've kind of been a champion for individual investors now for over 20 years, you know, started the index investing show back in what it was 2005, right?
Yep.
I think.
Yep. 2005.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So how did you kind of take, and you definitely have that perspective of the Wall Street outsider, you know, how did you kind of come to that and we're getting into it. Why doesn't Wall Street work for the individual investor?
Well, I've always taken the road less traveled in life. And so my history, instead of going to business school like everyone else, I went to art school. And after I graduated with a degree in graphic design, guess what happened to me, Kirk? I belatedly realized that the best earning artists were all dead. And it was way too early for me to die. So I got into the financial services business, that I began working in a family-run financial planning firm in Chicago. I worked with my uncle. And by the way, the main reason I went to art school is because at the time, I didn't want to buy or read any books. And my understanding of college at that time was that there were lots of books involved, and I didn't want any part of it. So I went to art school instead. And when I enrolled, I asked one of my art instructors, what I should bring to my first day of class. And she said to me to bring a blank piece of paper and some charcoal for drawing pictures. And I was absolutely thrilled with her answer. And that's what I did. On my first day, I brought a blank piece of paper and some charcoal for drawing, and a female model. She stepped up onto the platform and she removed all her clothing. And my teacher said to us, start drawing.
Wow.
And now,
wow.
as perverted as that may sound, Henry David Thoreau said that the question is not what you look at, but how you look and whether you see. And going to art school, what it did, Kurt, is it taught me to see. It taught me to challenge the status quo. And in the context of a person's investment portfolio, it taught me how to see beyond the superficiality of the surface. but to dig deeper into whether a portfolio is architecturally sound and whether it's truly compatible with a person's, you know, that person's goal, their risk profile, their unique personality, all those things. And so after years of trying to unsuccessfully explain to people all these things that impact their actual performance results, that's what I've been trying to do with the Index Investing Show, it led me to create something called the Portfolio Report Card. And so, but it was my training, oddly enough, in a completely different field, and a completely different discipline that has brought me to this point. And so I think there's a lot to be said for that cross-disciplinary, learning that, has taught me to see. I don't look at things the way Wall Street looks at things, or even the general public looks at things. I like to think that I see things differently, and hopefully, in a way that can provide some insight and meaning to the individuals that I encounter.
Okay. Yeah. And I would totally agree with you on seeing things a little bit differently. You know, for instance, I was actually a history major at the Coast Guard Academy. And I think that helps me quite a bit as a financial planner, just to provide a different context, to look at things from a more historical viewpoint than just focused on the numbers. And I think it helps. And I could definitely probably see it with the art as well.
Yeah. 99% of all statistics only tell us 49% of the story 100% yeah. of the time.
So you've kind of mentioned you look at things a little bit differently. And, both of us have kind of been big proponents for, low cost index investing, especially in exchange traded funds. And, when you and I met, I think it was sometime in the early 2000s, but ETFs were really kind of a new fad at that point, and just a few billion dollars in assets. But, we still had a situation where 70% of the investing world was actively managed, especially actively managed mutual funds. So now we're in a world where index investing is about 50% of the investment landscape, with ETFs over $1 trillion in assets. So, looking back over the past 15 years or so, are you pretty surprised at how things have gone?
Well, not really, but people forget in that history. I mean, we were trailblazers. We still are, Kurt. At the time when we were endorsing ETFs, ETFs had a lot of enemies. Among them, John Bogle, the default father of indexing, the guy who single-handedly helped more investors anywhere on the planet. And yet here are products that are an extension of that philosophy, indexing, that are in a different wrapper, ETFs. And here's a person that, to his very death, was demonizing ETFs. Mm-hmm. And so it wasn't always as clear cut as it is today, that ETFs would become what they have turned into, mainstream vehicles that are portfolio building blocks. And so I guess what that taught us is to be counterintuitive, admit that prevailing wisdom might be popular, but not necessarily right. There were a lot of people at the time that were saying, well, ETFs, every time you buy them, there's a commission charge incurred. They encourage people to day trade their retirement accounts, all these myths, these half-truths that were being levied at ETFs. And so what we learned from that is we reject these old paradigms that are built upon superstition and half-truths, and we can question and we can challenge consensus viewpoints rather than blindly embracing them. And then also, we have to just look at what's best for investors, right? ETFs encompass all of the things that are right for investors. They have low annual cost. They have for taxable brokerage accounts, they have something called tax efficiency, which is wonderful. We don't want to pay more taxes than we need to. And they give us broad, diversified asset exposure to the major asset classes, which is the very foundation of portfolio construction. And so, you know, let's not forget that, you know, we focus on where we're at right now, but it wasn't always so clear cut for ETFs that they would become what they've become today. And again, that's mainstream investment product that everyone talks about.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't, I think at one of the conferences, probably was 04, 05, I think you were there, but the big topic was bond ETFs. And most people said, there's no way we're going to have anything other than maybe a total bond, because, you know, you can't do municipals. They're the illiquid markets, and, you know, small junk bonds. You can't do junk bonds in an ETF. You know, the market's way too illiquid. And look, and just look how many bond instruments there are now, how many ETFs that have bonds. It's amazing. It's amazing.
Yeah, they just crossed, bond ETFs just crossed $1 trillion in assets.
Yeah.
Just this year, which is an incredible milestone. And mind you, that's without the help of 401k money. You know, the only reason bond mutual funds still have more assets is because they're getting greased by the 401k mafia. You
sure.
know, and the 401k mafia has decided to exclude ETFs from the mix because ETFs are too much of a threat to their royalty mm-hmm. and to their monopoly. And so they're still using mutual funds as vehicles inside 401k plans. Eventually, someday, I'd like to see ETFs be part of 401k menus and replace mutual funds. You know, that's something that I've been watching for. It's a slow evolution, but it'll happen over time,
sure.
I think.
Yeah, I agree. And it is amazing, though, how many people now do have a kind of an understanding of just buying broad indexes. Like I said, you know, 50% now are more passively managed assets on the investing landscape. So now the big argument from the active side is, well, with so much more money parked in these these passive investing vehicles, that now active management makes sense. Do you agree with that at all, or do you think you're still better off as an investor to focus on sort of passive investing?
Well, when it comes to active management versus passive, the thing that investors need to understand is that active managers, in a court of law, you are innocent until proven guilty, right? So with mm-hmm. active managers, it's just the opposite. They're guilty until they're proven innocent, because all the historical data is the exact opposite of what they say. And it's damning. It's damning against them. And so they've also promoted false theories like active management outperforms and bear markets. That's when your active managers tend to do the best and really earn their keep. And again, as a group, that the data, when you analyze active managers as a group, none of the data supports that false claim. And so I've always said that, well, not always, but my view on this has changed. In the past, I used to be against all types of active management, and now I've become less dogmatic in my view. Okay. I believe that the core of the investment portfolio should absolutely be indexed to the market. And of course, the easiest way to do that is to use index-based funds, index ETFs that are linked to major asset classes like stocks, bonds, real estate, and commodities. And then, of course, cash is another major asset class. So that's your core. And then if people want to invest in active managers, if they want to invest in venture capital, private equity, cryptocurrencies, individual stocks, whatever crazy ideas come to their head, active management, do that with your play money, which is your non-core portfolio. It's the much smaller slice of your investments that can be earmarked for that that type of investing. And it's within that context, I think active management is okay. But that's the only context. If you're going to invest in active management, in my view, based on my experience, that's the only context where active management belongs within a person's portfolio. Again, that's a non-core investment portfolio, the much smaller portion, which is sometimes referred to in institutional circles as the satellite portion of a person's portfolio. So again, it's the, you know, it's not the foundation. It's maybe you might say the icing on the cake. It's not the cake.
Okay. Yeah, that makes total sense. And you kind of made a, you talked about how you've done the portfolio report card for people and you've examined, I think you said now more than 200 million in investor portfolios. So as you look back, what are the biggest mistakes you see that investors make?
Wow. I mean, that's all over the place. It's hard to really say what the number one mistake is. I mean, there's so many possibilities to make, you know, mistakes, but I would say probably taxes is one of the big ones that's misunderstood. I used to think that the only thing that mattered when it comes to analyzing a portfolio was like the tax efficiency if the portfolio is made up mostly of mutual funds, I would just look at the tax efficiency of those mutual funds and kind of grade the portfolio that way. Now I'm looking at it more of a, you know, from the perspective of, does the portfolio temporarily minimize taxes or permanently minimize taxes? So how much of the portfolio, for example, has tax-deferred assets versus tax-free assets like Roth IRA? Is there a healthy balance there? And what I have found is that most people have the bulk of their assets in investments that only temporarily minimize taxes. These are tax-deferred vehicles like IRA, traditional IRA, 401k plans, 403b, 457, but they do not deal with the possibility, very likely possibility, of higher taxes in the future. So, you know, my framework, I'm beginning to look at, you know, portfolios. I see a lot of these mistakes where people have, you know, 7-8-figure portfolios all in the tax-deferred bucket, and that's a tax problem for these people when they retire. It causes Social Security to become taxed because distributions are so large that that they can't be controlled. And of course, as you age, those distributions get bigger and bigger, and it's a vicious circle, creating this tax problem that you can't escape. And so, you know, that would say, I don't know that there's one mistake that really stands out more than the others, but I will say maybe the biggest mistake is probably just the imbalance that people have in their portfolios and the lack of use of things like Roth IRA.
Okay. Yeah, and I think this is going to become even more important for a couple of reasons. One, you mentioned tax rates at some point are going to definitely have to go up with the shortfalls that are projected in Social Security, Medicare, and then just the general spendthrift nature of our government. At some point, we're going to see rates go up considerably. But then secondly, I don't know if you're following the workings of the SECURE Act. They're now going to require that any inherited IRA that isn't a spouse is going to have to be distributed over 10 years. So you're going to be, if you inherit one of these IRAs, you're going to probably get pushed in a higher tax bracket just because you have to take it out over a 10-year period. So yeah, taxes are going to become a bigger and bigger part of investment returns.
Well, I think that we're in a honeymoon period. If you look at the Tax Jobs Act cut or whatever it's called that was passed in 2017, it sunsets in 2025. So what we know for sure is taxes are guaranteed to be the same from now until 2025. This is like the third lowest income tax rate in like 80 years. Mm-hmm. And so for retirees, that provides a window to look at things like improving their tax situation by, you know, if we're uncertain about what future tax rates are going to be, I mean, do we really want to roll the dice with a government that's this spendthrift, that's this deep in debt, that's this, you know, reckless when it comes to deficits and all kinds of spending? By then, Trump will be long gone. And so, you know, you're really rolling the dice. You can reduce some of that tax rate risk by simply shifting money into things like, you know, Roth IRA conversions. Those of us that are still participating in the company 401k plan, talk to your employer, ask them if they've got a Roth 401k option, and start using some of these vehicles. Heck, I don't like to pay taxes. You don't. Nobody does. But if we're going to pay taxes, we might as well do it when rates are at 80-year lows. I'd rather do that and pay it now and get it out of the way and be done with it permanently than have to roll the dice about future tax rates.
Yeah, that's good advice. Well, Ron, I just want to finish with one more question I always ask my guests. So if you could go back in time and talk to the, 22-year-old Ron, what financial advice would you give him? What did he do well that put you in a good spot for today? But what could he have done a little bit better?
Well, I'd say eliminate ideas and habits that foster inconsistency. Recognize that successful execution is harder when you complicate your investment approach. And remember that repeating your mistakes creates bad results and leads to the wrong type of consistency. That's okay. What I would say.
Okay. Is there anything in particular you could kind of point to that you feel like you can remember something where maybe it was behavior that you kept going to that didn't work for you? Or
One of my problems was I was a stop and go saver. Stop and go. And I had debt when I was young. It wasn't college debt, but it was debt that I created, and it was a burden. And so what I realized is that no matter how much debt a person has, I realized that I'm going to be working, I'm going to be earning a paycheck, and I need to pay myself first. I need to set aside money and have some self-respect and pay myself first. And so that's what I eventually came to the realization that I have to do that. And I've done it ever since. But I hear many people that are, my 22-year-old self that always say, well, I can't afford to save. I'll save once I pay off all my debts. Well, let me get you the memo. You're never going to pay off all your debts. You're always going to have debt. You'll have a mortgage. You'll have a family. There's always going to be. And by the way, I know debt is demonized by people like Dave Ramsey. Debt is a tool. If it's used properly, it can actually be quite beneficial. I don't endorse his advice that everybody should get to even, right? Because if you pay all your debts, then everyone's even, right? Let's get the entire country to even. That's the Dave Ramsey way. My way is let's get people ahead. Forget about getting even. We need to get people ahead. When they pay off all their debt, they're just even, but they're not getting ahead. And so if you have debt, whether it's mortgage debt or credit card debt or student loans or whatever, make sure it's manageable. But moreover, make sure you're still saving some money and paying yourself first. The idea that you're going to start saving money after you pay all your debts is absolutely heinous.
Yeah.
Stop deluding yourself. It's not true. It's never going to happen. You know that. And it's just an excuse that people use to be financially reckless.
Yep. Yeah. It's amazing, having talked with tons of people, advise them. Young people feel like they have a ton of time ahead of them. And then you get people kind of in their 40s, early 50s, and they've got kids. Okay, once the kids are through school, then I'll have time. And then they get into their 50s or even late 50s, and then they get this attitude like, well, now it's too late. So yeah, you're right. You've got to make it a priority. You've got to do it when you're young. And the beautiful thing is, if you start when you're young, you don't have to do that much to get big results. So
yeah, because you have the compounding effect that works in your favor.
Sure.
But the problem is the mentality, the psychology is wrong when you're young, because you want it all right now. And you also think, too, that it's such a small amount, it doesn't matter. And that's where the psychology aspect, the habits come into play. And that's usually what we end up doing. We end up self-destroying. It's not a bad market that damages us. It's not a recession. It's not a depression. It's not anything external that ends up damaging us. It's usually ourselves.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. Well, Ron, this has been fantastic. I know anybody listening has gotten a ton out of this, but where can they find you to get even more information?
Well, you can check out my book. It's on Amazon.com. It's called Habits of the Investing Greats. And you can also follow me on Twitter. @DeLegiRon is my Twitter handle. And DeLegi is spelled D as in David, E-L-E-G-G-E-R-O-N, Ron. And you can pick me up there. And I also, of course, do the Index Investing Show, which is available on Spotify, iTunes, as well as Google Play.
Okay.
So I'm out there.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And Ron, it was great catching up with you, and I sincerely appreciate your time.
Thanks a lot, Kirk. It was a blast.
Okay. Take care. So that's going to do it for this episode of the Saving Yourself from Wall Street podcast. Again, Ron has been generous enough to give us some copies of his book for any listeners. And all I'm asking you to do is to go to iTunes and leave a review for the Saving Yourself from Wall Street podcast. Again, we really would appreciate some good numbers there, some high marks. And then what you do is just email Kirk at savingyourselffromwallstreet.com. Give me your username for iTunes so I can validate that you did, in fact, leave a review. And then get me your address, and I will send you a copy of his book. Again, I can't do international shipping, but I'm very happy to do anything in the United States. So again, thanks for listening. If you have any comments or questions, please let us know. And now, the lawyers say hi.
Saving Yourself from Wall Street is hosted by Kirk Kinder. Kirk Kinder is the owner of Picket Fence Financial, a fee-only financial planning firm. Picket Fence Financial is regulated by the states of Maryland and Florida in accordance and in compliance with securities laws and regulations. Picket Fence Financial does not render or offer to render personalized financial or tax advice through the Saving Yourself from Wall Street podcast. The information provided is for informational purposes only and does not constitute financial, tax, investment, or legal advice.